Hi there, my name's Jeremy Thomas, and I am the host of Shed Talks. Shed Talks hopes to be an entertaining, informative podcast that looks at well-being and mental health. And I hope you're going to like it. I'm going to be in conversation with well-known, interesting figures, personalities from the world of film, telly, music, gardening, sport, and literature, and even prisons. Each person will have a serious connection with mental health, and we are going to learn loads. Now, when it gets to the end of that conversation, don't rush off, because we have got the illustrious, wondrous psychologist Karen Cowan on hand to discuss what's been said and to give us some insight and various tips on what we can do with our mental health. It's all going to be great. Enjoy. So, welcome to episode 3 of Shed Talks. We are very lucky to have lured and secured the wonderful Roma Hooper. Roma is a force of nature, someone who does not take no for an answer, someone not afraid to knock on any door. She should be known as Roma the Relentless. She's been a tremendous campaigner for criminal justice, founded Make Justice Work 2008, having successfully set up Europe's first prison radio in Feltham Young Offenders. She went on to support and fundraise and found many other campaigns and charities, but is probably best known for founding the highly successful and award-winning Prison Radio Association, which eventually became a prison radio service, and is fantastic. She was awarded the OBE in 2017 for services to prisons and is, without doubt, a very, very top person. What very few people know about Roma, and I see a look of nervousness spreading over her face, is that she was awarded in 1977 the Royal Humane Society Award for saving a man's life. Roma, welcome to The Shed.
Thank you, Jeremy. Lovely introduction. I'm quite embarrassed.
Well, I have to, cut straight to the chase. You will have a gag or two in a minute, but I couldn't really say that about the Royal Humane Society Award and then not ask you what actually happened, because I know it was on the River Thames, I believe.
Yes, it was in St Catherine's Dock. It was the year of, I think it must have been the Silver Jubilee in 1977, and I was organising a function on one of these big Dutch barges with the people I was working with at the time. And we were kind of three barges out into the into St Catherine's Dock, and people were getting pretty merry. And anyway, I came out on top because some friends of mine had just arrived. As right. I came out on top of the boat, this other chap who was the husband of someone I used to work with, he came out, he was really quite under the weather. And before I knew where he'd slipped into the water, and it was dark, and he slipped in between these two barges, the barge we were on and the barge next door. And as he was doing that, he went under, and the boats began to move together.
Oh, my God.
So, honestly, you don't think with these sorts of things. I just jumped in, and I found him head down. So I sort of grabbed his head, grabbed hold of a rope, and was shouting. And then people came out, and actually, somebody else got an award for keeping the boats from crushing us.
Right.
Because they were coming in. Anyway, they got him out. He was unconscious. He had to go to hospital, have his stomach pumped. And he did recover, thankfully. I think he was mortified, absolutely mortified. But yeah, I didn't know that I was put forward for the award. And The thing is, Jeremy, what was so wonderful was that my grandfather had got a similar award about 80 years before.
Fantastic.
For jumping into the Medway to pull somebody out. So it was special.
You were channeling him.
Well, as little did I know.
Gosh, that's fantastic. No, it's really something to save someone's life. And, you know, I don't think that many people would be going, oh, yes, I don't worry about it being dark and horrible and their boats crashing into each other. I'll jump in. But you did. And that's, you know, and I think that's great. And anyway, thank you for that. As you know, this program has an undercurrent of mental health and how people cope with it. So we are going to have some fun, but we're also going to have some serious bits, you know. You, if I'm not wrong, grew up in a place called Tidworth.
Yes, I did.
And that, I think, is about 30 or 40 miles from Wincanton up the 303. Oh, okay. And you had an older brother. And is your sister older than you? Or
no,
you?
I have a younger sister.
Right.
And then a younger brother. We're only 14 months apart.
Right. So are you all, pretty close? Were you pretty close?
We're very close. And in fact, some people find it quite unusual. We're a bit like triplets.
Right.
Because of the circumstances, which we'll obviously talk about, that we grew up in, we really, really have always stuck together.
Yes.
Well, my mother used to sort of call us puppies. We just were always together. So we are unusually close.
Yes. No, I mean, I understand that. And I think that's called something to do with survivors, being survivors. But is that right that you grew up within an army setting?
Yeah, my father was in the army. So we grew up in Tidworth. And then he came out of the army when I was about 8 or 9. And then we moved to a village in Hampshire. And he left the army at that point. So we did. We grew up in this sort of, well, it was actually lovely. We were quite free and loose to do what we wanted. It was very different, you know, then than it is now. There wasn't the fear around, you know, children going out and playing on the street. So, no, it was good.
Excellent. But we know really that things went pretty sadly wrong.
Yes.
Would you mind telling us, you know, what happened and, you know, the knock-on effects, really?
Yes, because it had a major impact and changed our lives dramatically. I suppose me being slightly older than the other two, I was slightly aware of the tension between my parents, which largely sort of used to sit around money. My father was a very unusual guy. He was extremely good looking, very charismatic. He was a count, Dutch count, and he'd grown up in this complex, very difficult family environment. Mm-hmm. And anyway, he and my mother were clearly having problems. He came out of the army, I think, in a bit of a cloud, but I'm not entirely sure.
Right.
And we moved to this village but my mother eventually bought a house there through some money she was left by her half-sister. And my father began working in a separate business. But it became apparent that he wasn't coping at all well in the outside world. And you have to remember, in those days, when people came out of the army, it's not like now, when I suspect there's a lot more support for people.
Yes, absolutely.
As they're moving into civvy world, if you like.
Yeah.
And he was clearly struggling. And, you know, but in those days, no one ever said a word to us. We only found out years later that he'd actually left when I was 9. So we'd come out of the army, moved into a rented place while we had this cottage sort of done up. And he'd gone to live in London. We didn't even know he'd left home. No one had said anything. And he'd come home at weekends sometimes. And we just got used to him not being around. And literally, I mean, I can't tell you, literally, I can remember it was New Year's Day, 1964. I'd gone down the road. I was walking back and I could hear these screams in our house. And I don't know, Jeremy, somehow or other, I knew something terrible had happened. And it was when I came back and my mother said that my father had died.
Right.
But they didn't tell us why or how. They just said he died. And then no one ever spoke about him again.
Gosh, how extraordinary.
We were told he'd got a bug. We told he'd been in Spain. God knows, I don't know where that... But he was in a property company, gone to Spain, picked up a bug and died. And that was all we were told. And we never spoke about him again.
So how old were you when you discovered that he had committed suicide?
I was 17, 18. But it was complicated because even the thing is, to give you a bit of context, he only committed suicide about a year and a half after the Suicide Act came in, which stopped making suicide as a criminal act.
Oh, yes.
So, of course, nobody could talk about it. Nobody wanted to talk about it. So we grew up with this thing that he'd got this bug. And then I went to college and I became friends with this girl whose boyfriend's father had shot himself. And he found him. And we were talking one day about him. And Tony said, well, didn't your father kill himself? I said, no. I said, he died of a bug. And so I went home to my mother and said, is it true that he killed himself? And she denied it. And she said something like, oh, we took too many tablets, but then never mentioned it again. But then I spoke to my godfather, who's a really good friend of my father's, and he told me the truth. My sister and my brother were both at school then, so I had to phone up the school and get them. I had to speak to my headmistress at where I'd just left to explain to my sister and my brother what had happened, because I didn't want them to find out the way I did.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we knew the truth, but we never told my mother that we knew until years later.
Years later,
when I finally thought, she's going to have to know that we know that he killed himself. So we just talked about it with one another. And I was very fortunate. I had a really good relationship with one or two of my mother's friends. And I learned so much about what had gone on. And then when my son was born, he was born on my father's birthday.
Right.
And I remember my mother arriving at the hospital. She just sat with a bottle of whiskey and got drunk. Now, fortunately, I knew why. But I knew then at some point I was going to have to tell her that I knew.
Yes.
So about 9 months later, I sat her down at her kitchen table. I said, I think you need to know that you don't have to hide from this anymore. We do all know, and we understand. And it was then, and I found it. My brother sent it to me. My mother then, I was sitting at the kitchen table a couple of years later, and she came up to me and she said, darling, I think you can have this now. And she gave me his suicide letter.
Blimey.
Which was brutal.
Who was it written to, if you don't mind me asking?
It was written to my mother.
And was it placatory or was it the opposite?
Oh, it was so deeply tragic.
Gosh.
So terribly, terribly sad. And it explained, and always has explained, the pain that my mother then carried on to endure, because she then started drinking. And, you know, I think when I read the letter and I read it again, actually both my brother and my sister and I were really upset about it two nights ago. So this is really raw, Jeremy. I'm sorry.
Right. Oh, I'm sorry.
Because it really brought it to a fore. But it, again, it just helps you to forgive and move on.
Yeah. My God.
You just can't hold it. You can't hold it. You've got to let it go.
But it's terribly, poignant is rather a pathetic word in this. You know, how awful it must be to read that letter, even now. Because I don't know what was in it, but I'm just assuming you're really seeing somebody in terrible, terrible trauma, anguish, pain, and all that, and they know what they're about to do, which is it's just extraordinary.
It is, and it's something which I think I've done quite a lot of work in prisons around training volunteers, and one of the things that we talk about is suicide is a selfish act.
Yeah.
And only when you've experienced it like I have, do you realize that is completely untrue. One, it takes a huge amount of courage, but it's never, it's there. The people do it because they think they're doing the right thing for the people yes. around them. It is not a selfish act. And, you know, seeing that letter again just reminded me the depths of the despair that he had. I mean, he literally, if I can say, he literally enclosed in that envelope a 10-shilling note. And that was all he had left.
Right. So he felt that he'd... Did he feel that he'd let everybody down by not being able to earn more money or, you know, having come out of the army? And...
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
And he, you know, and it's, to some respects, he did rescue us from what could have been a very difficult, more complicated life. It would just been really different. I would have much rather he'd been around. But, you know, it wasn't to be. He felt that he couldn't, he basically couldn't rectify the situation he was in.
Yes.
He was in debt, I suspect, and probably would have ended up in real difficulty, actually, and would have got us into real difficulty. So,
well, and also debt in those days.
It was terrible.
It sounds a stupid thing to say, doesn't it? But, you know, if you went bankrupt in the 1960s and the 1950s, you know, it was a disgrace. Yeah. And, you know, that's... All of this shame, isn't it? It's all that shame and everything. But God, I mean, that's very, very shocking. And I'm really, you know, grateful for you telling us about it, because I think it's a very important thing that this is talked about. And I think, you know, when we were talking a couple of weeks back, I said that, you know, it's one of my things that to try and deal with this subject, because it is very difficult, and especially for people who are, as well, you know, people who are left, I don't know. I mean, so when this happened, you went off to school.
Yes, I mean, there's always a light there, you know. There's always a light. It's a bit like that wonderful poem that came out at the inauguration yesterday by Amanda Gorman. If you can see the light, you'll find the light. And what happened was the regiment that he was in were so devastated by what had happened that they actually put money into a fund to send us all away to school so that we all got bursaries. So it didn't cost anybody anything. We got army bursaries. It cost them, but it didn't cost my mother a bean. Because she had to work.
Yes.
So going off to boarding school was, for my sister and I, less so for my brother, was an absolute sanctuary.
Yeah. So, you know, you are an extraordinary adaptable person, I think. But how did you make sense of what happened, his suicide? How did you explain it and make sense of it to yourself?
Well, one of the things which was really important was to be transparent to other people.
Yeah.
So not to be embarrassed or awkward about talking about it. So when people would ask me, you know, about your father, and you people do, and you say, well, he died. And it's a natural question, what did he die of? I've never shied away from that. So that's given me courage that actually... I'm not ashamed of what happened. I'm not hiding behind a truth, and I suppose that's been my mantra all my life: is to try and be honest and transparent, we all find things that make us feel better able to cope. I suppose mine is always around friends and relationships, and not. Being, if you're with people who are afraid to have that conversation with Jeremy, it's not very healthy.
No, and also, but I think there are people, there were people for sure in the 1960s and 70s who, you know, perhaps had that situation where mum or dad had committed suicide and they would, you know, hide it and just go, no, they died of cancer or whatever, and then be caught out later and... I mean, you know, you can see it. I think so many people just want to be one of the gang. And one of the sort of normal, yes, I'm Mr. and Mrs. Normal. My parents are Mr. and Mrs. Normal. Certain people anyway. But I think you're absolutely right. I think the truth will set you free. And I think that is true.
Yes. And I think, and also what I was lucky with was that I didn't give up on finding the answers. So at every opportunity with my, particularly my mother's friends, I try and actually, to be honest, I learned a great deal more, which built up a picture, and it created a sort of context to what had happened, because it was such an extraordinary thing to have to live with for the three of us. But then I discovered there were other things about my own personal situation, which was utterly different from my brother and my sisters. So the difficulty that you have when someone does that is you think that they don't love you.
Yes. How could
so
they? Yeah.
You
yeah.
kind of grow up craving people's affection. You want
yes.
people to like you.
Yes.
And that's an unintended consequence of experiencing someone very close to you dying of suicide. And actually never really, really getting over that either. Feeling that actually you want to make people happy and you want people to love you.
Yes.
Because when someone leaves you like that, you think, well, they clearly didn't love you. And it wasn't true, but it felt like that.
Well, also, it's a big gap in your life anyway, isn't it? Because it's your dad.
Yeah.
I mean, what I do find interesting, not in a salacious way, I hope, but what I do find interesting is the knock-on effects of this, these situations. And, you know, it looks like it had quite a serious effect on your mother. I mean, did you ever manage to talk to her about the whole thing?
Yes, a little bit, yes. She did open up and she explained how she was told about his death and how that they had separated. And she never, ever, ever said a bad word against him.
Right.
Which I think was extraordinary. She was a very difficult, sometimes very difficult woman, but she never, never slagged him off. It was extraordinary. She was so loyal to his memory. And actually people generally that I spoke to were very, very good about that. And actually I wish we'd been more involved in all of that when we were younger. Because his father was still alive and living in Holland. And both the three of us had to piece together what he was actually like because no one talked to us about him. So,
did you make contact?
Yes. Yeah. And it was wonderful because we did find out much more about him and what led up to the situation that he then found himself in. But it's been a journey. And do you know what? It's like all of us with parents. You wish you'd ask more questions. There are still things I wish I knew more about. But she wasn't very open to talking about it. She found it very difficult and didn't really want to talk about it very much because it clearly was a terrible experience for her. And unfortunately, what it created was a period of time when I was very angry with her for quite a long time.
Yeah, yeah, I understand that.
And then I was really, really angry with him. But yes. Now I'm not angry with anybody. It's gone.
You've done being angry.
Done being angry.
But I think that it's a really understandable emotion and something that needs to be faced because that can actually do you in, that anger.
It's awful.
And I think it's great that you did face it. I mean, I imagine that your mum had some feeling or degree of guilt about the situation.
Yes. Yeah, and actually I didn't know. I mean, there's an element in his letter, and I think, how could he have written that? To leave that with her? Because he died two days before Christmas.
Right.
She never told us. She didn't tell us until he was buried on New Year's Day.
Gosh.
So she kept that secret all over Christmas for our sakes.
Amazing.
Which She was extraordinary. And she had a difficult upbringing too. So it wasn't like her life had been a bed of roses. But, you know, in the end, I think it was all just too much.
But, you know, it is that stuff of inheritance tracks, whatever that program talks about, isn't it? That, you know, your father's mother committed suicide and your mother's family background was really difficult. What sort of thing was that? Was it just unhappy?
Yes, she was unhappy. She was always seeking. I think she always thought other people could solve her problem and make things better. She didn't really ever fully understand that that had to come from her. She was always sort of dissatisfied with life, which was awful because actually she had a lot of very good things going on for her because she had three children. My sister and I both had three children of our own. My brother left sticks and went to move to the States and never came back. And he got out.
He escaped.
He escaped. And actually my sister escaped too. She went to Yorkshire and I was sort of, I chose to stay with her and I can't ever say anything else because obviously that had its benefits, but it also had its curse. We felt that whatever she had, it was never quite enough. She just never really recovered. She never fell in love with anybody else, which is what my father wanted her to do. She never met anybody else. She was only 40 when he died.
Goodness.
41. So, you know, oh no, she was 42. But actually, it wasn't. It really didn't really make her very happy at all. She never really recovered from it.
Yes. Yeah.
Moments. She did have moments. And we did have some really fun times with her. Don't get me wrong. We did have some very happy times with her. But it was, you never quite knew what was going to come next.
Well, I imagine that it was very good, as you said, going off to, you know, boarding school. Because although a lot of people go, oh, my God, it must have been awful going to boarding school. You know, I know certain people... and you know certain people, and including yourself, where actually, thank you so much. I just really need to be here to mess around and be my, you know, my age and not have to sort of go through adult stuff. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, you couldn't be more right. Because I was free. I didn't have to worry about her.
Yeah.
And I was at school with my sister, and actually I didn't have to worry about her either because she was all right. But as soon as I came home and I left school, oh, the weight. So what I did, I met somebody, 18, left home within a year, got married at 20.
Yes. Well, it sort of makes sense, doesn't it? I mean,
yes.
I mean, in a sad way, but, you know, because you need to be in your own canoe and you've got somebody who's loving you or whatever, or making you feel wanted. And this is great, you know. But I suspect that wasn't the answer.
It wasn't, but I don't regret it. Because
right.
It got me through a difficult time. And actually, I know other people who've had similar situations who did that. I would have been, looking back, I would have been very surprised if it had lasted. But I would never regret it because it gave me a degree of stability for a period of time it wasn't great splitting up, I have to say.
Really?
But then I do believe that you can never ignore, you must never waste a bad experience.
Because they teach you things or?
Because they teach you things and it gives you something about resilience to take forward. But don't ever regret the bad things that go wrong. You can't, because they happen. They're in the past. It's the one thing you have no control over. You can't change it. So one of the things it's helped me to do is support other people. So I've had quite a lot of things happen. So I've never shied away from sharing those things and saying, not that I could ever truly empathize with anybody, because no one can. But there's a level of understanding when you can reach out.
But the point is that if you are prepared to be transparent, tell the truth about what's happened to you, like now, somebody will listen to this and go, goodness, that's made all the difference, you know. And that might sound a bit sort of cheesy or whatever. I don't really care, because I mean, it's exactly what I do, you know.
Yes.
Talking about bipolar and alcoholism, yes, and, you know, addiction, yes, all these things. People need authenticity.
Yes.
And it matters a lot to get it, you know. But is this why, you know, I mean, this is not a documentary on Roma Hooper, although I quite like it to be, but we haven't got time. But is this why you sort of fast forwarded and ended up at Feltham and setting up that radio station? Is that what drove you in that direction?
Interestingly enough, I mean, because I was in the voluntary sector before then with a charity called Contact to Family,
right,
which was working with quite profoundly disabled young children. It was two things. First of all, my next-door neighbour, Mark Robinson, who was the person who'd gone into Feltham and suggested the radio station, because there had been 5 suicides,
yes,
very quickly of children and young people in that prison. And I can't say that I was driven to there because of my own experience. No, it's because he persuaded me to go in. I used to fundraise a lot, so that was one of my skills.
Yeah.
He needed help with the fundraising. But I went in with him, and actually, I suppose this is my perverse way of being, it was one of the most difficult places I've ever been. I thought, well, if I'm going to make a difference, it's going to be here, because this is really tough here.
Yes.
This is really hard.
Don't they have a huge amount of young prisoners there?
They had 900 at the time.
Blimey.
It was the biggest young offender prison in Europe in,
right,
1991, 92. And it was pretty grim. And that's how Mark had suggested, well, why don't we put in a radio station? And the then governor said yes, but he said, I can't give you any money or anything. I'll tell you where you can put it. So I went in and started helping to raise the money, and I got completely and utterly hooked.
Brilliant.
Totally
brilliant.
Hooked. Not just by the radio station, the work we were doing there, but just also the people there, the young people, the staff. It was something that just, it's like I've been waiting for it.
And it was, well, also I suspect with you that although you are quite a petite size, I would say, you are a pretty fearless person. And I reckon you weren't afraid.
No, I'm not afraid.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid, no.
And I
right.
think a lot of people would be afraid of going into a prison. I mean, it is quite an experience. But I guess with you, you'd probably go, right, stuff and nonsense, here we go.
I didn't even think about it, but actually, that's classic me. I didn't really think about it. I just thought, this is something that I really wanted to do. And it was, the timing was right. The need was enormous. And I just thought, with my experience with fundraising and working in the voluntary sector anyway, I could bring something to the table. So I went as a volunteer, and I worked as a volunteer for about 7 or 8 years there.
Yeah. Can I just, you know, make a suggestion? This might be a load of bollocks. Was your father somebody who had a sense of fairness, sense of injustice, you know, what was people were being treated badly, or was that just me making that up?
Well, he may have done. I mean, he was in a family with divorced parents, so he had a really tough time. But do you know what I think more was that when he died, people were so generous to us.
Yes.
And the benefit of receiving, which my mother was really good at, actually, she accepted support, that actually, and this is nothing, I don't mean this to sound sort of, you know, evangelical, but the idea of being able to support others, knowing what it had felt like for me, just seemed to make complete sense.
Yes.
I didn't look back to think, oh, was there something that was driving it? The only thing I could ever think about was we were so fortunate because people stepped in and helped.
Yeah.
People
step in and help, you know, when they care about people. don't they? I mean, it's so it was probably your mum, and also that people had had, you know, great experiences of your father, and
yes,
they wanted to help. You know, that's what we all do, isn't it? You know, you want to help somebody because you really, really like that person that did so much for you.
And I guess with the prison, they're just kids. You know, they may have had bad experiences and committed crimes and whatever, but it was still just kids and not to be fearful of. And I suppose the other thing was, when I look back at my brother, my sister and I, how we survived terrible things happening, because there were more, then people can come out of it. People can change their lives and turn things around. And I thought, I didn't think about it that deeply, but I knew the radio station was absolutely critical, because these youngsters were stuck in their cells probably at that time 20 hours a day.
Yeah.
And they didn't have televisions, or they had to have, they could buy a radio through the sort of canteen, such as canteen, but they didn't have anything else. They had a phone on the landing and that was it. No communication. And when you realise that their level of education was complex and literacy levels were low, it made sense.
That's amazing, isn't it? I mean, I'm playing a devil's advocate. Have you had any flack from people? You know,
We did at the beginning, when we first started out in about 2008 or 2007, 2008, somebody, a journalist, bowed out about it. And we were on the front page of The Sun, you know, lags have their own radio station. And it was absolutely ghastly.
Whatever next?
We thought we'd be closed down.
Yeah.
But in fact, Jack Straw intervened and stood up for us. And that was the beginning of the most amazing relationship we have now with the prison service and the Ministry of Justice. So it was awful at the time, but we survived it and we keep our heads down.
Yes.
We are very, very good as a radio station. And so that was, well, you know, 10, 12 years ago. But we now have regular financing, you know, a grant from the Ministry of Justice to help support the prison radio station, National Prison Radio.
I was reading about you, and I don't know whether it was Feltham or somewhere else, but you said a really good thing, which I thought anyway, which is that the radio station really helped young kids, you know, who were in prison, who were terribly lonely, you know, at night.
Yeah.
And I imagine, you know, I can imagine that if you're not, you know, Flash Harry, Jack the Lad, you know, but you've just gone, it's gone wrong for you and you ended up in Clink, you know, that something like that is vital, just as a friend, you know, some sort. And I mean, this, you know, we could do another program about this, or another podcast about it, but,
yeah,
you know, what's the point of being in prison?
Well, as I said, that's a whole other conversation.
Which exactly.
Led me on to doing lots of other things. But I think that anyone who thinks it's easy needs to listen to what some of these people have to go through. It's not a good place. Not a good place, one, to put children. I think that's what drove me to try and persuade government to look much more carefully about how we sentence people in this country. Because we're very punitive, Jeremy,
yeah.
Really punitive. And people think that, yeah, sending them to prison is the punishment.
Yes.
There's the kind of expectation that you should continue punishment. I mean, there's been a big hoo-ha about, well, there wasn't a big hoo-ha because it lost its sort of voice, about prisoners being able to watch television. You have to understand, being stuck in a cell all day, every day, you eat your meals in your cell, you do your other business in the cell. It's degrading, it's inhuman. You wouldn't do it to a dog, quite
yeah.
frankly. And we think it's quite all right to do it to men, women and children. Many who've got mental health issues and who have absolutely committed crimes, but who are very often not given the chance to even try and move forward. The system is so so complex.
It is, but as you say, we live in a society that is based on crime and punishment. But we need to now move on, actually, to that subject of life jackets and what keeps you afloat.
Literally, yes.
And that's kind of important in your story, actually.
It is.
Isn't
totally.
It? I mean, tell me about fishing. Why do you like fishing?
Oh, gosh, isn't that? Yeah. I didn't really discover it until I was about 40. It's so good for the mind because, and we were fly fishing. Because, Jeremy, I have to concentrate so hard, I can't think about anybody else or anything else. All the demons go away. And it's just me, the line, and the fly.
Yes.
And if I'm lucky, occasionally a fish. People say to me, but you're so active. You love running around and doing things. But actually, as I've discovered with photography as well, it's the sheer joy of just being completely immersed in something. But also, there's hope. Because every time you cast, you think you're going to get a fish. So you just keep doing it like a complete idiot. You think that you're going to win.
I think you're a trainee gambler. film. I'm noticing you've put Love Actually.
Yes.
Why do you like that so much?
Oh, gosh. Well, I love the people in it.
Yes.
I love the whole storyline. It was just soppy and charming.
Funny.
And funny. And it just made me feel good.
Yes. We won't go through every one, but I mean, Charade,
yes.
Quite interesting. Audrey Hepburn, Walter Matthau. I mean, I love Walter Matthau.
Cary Grant.
Yeah. Is that the same thing? Is that comfort?
Yeah. I don't know. Well, there's another angle to that because actually I've always loved it, always loved her. But she's also happened to have been a great aunt of mine through marriage.
Who? Audrey Hepburn?
Audrey Hepburn.
Oh, because of the Dutch side.
Yes.
Wow, well,
she's
that's
married
not
to my great uncle. Yeah.
My goodness me, that's very snazzy to say that.
Yeah, but on the other hand, that wasn't just this. That's there, but there's something about her and the story. I've always loved it, and again, I watched it recently, and it hadn't changed an iota, and I still loved it.
I'm going to dig that out, actually. I'm going to dig that out. I think that's it's just got too many good people. Did you see Wait Until Dark with Audrey Hepburn?
Yes.
That was a great film. Yeah. Anyway, it's not for me to say that. can you, on books, can you tell us a bit about on Walden Pond?
Henry David Thoreau. Yes, I developed a bit of a crush on him as well. Mm-hmm. When I was doing my degree, it was a part-time English and sociology degree. I did a lot of American literature. And so I did a whole sort of module on Thoreau, Emerson, Walt Whitman, you name them, all that crowd that lived in a place called Concord outside of Boston.
All right. And
it's the most poetic, beautiful, short book. But it's about putting behind you all those materialistic things and just living a simple life. I mean, he had this classic phrase said, simplify, simplify, simplify. And maybe that's something we're all trying to do now, trying to simplify our lives and getting joy from the small things. And it is the most beautifully written book. I mean, he's completely barking. But beautifully written and says so much about how we complicate our lives and we have continued. I mean, I suppose he was very anti-industrialization. And he was very, very focused on nature. That whole cohort of writers
yes.
were very focused on nature. So there was something rather magical about it. And I think if you ever get to read it, it's really unusual and it's not a difficult read.
I look forward to that. I mean, I think the whole idea of, you know, keeping things simple and being, you know, just enjoying simple things is huge.
But he wasn't wanting to cut himself off. He wasn't wanting to separate himself from society.
Yeah.
He very much wanted to see nature and society somehow finding a way of living side by side. He didn't want to be away from people. I mean, he did go and live in the woods, by the way.
Right.
But there's outside Boston, in a shack, which I did go and visit it, actually. The shack wasn't there anymore, but where he grew up, where he lived.
Yeah.
But I have this wonderful story, whether it's true or not, that his mother used to come at weekends and take his washing away. he wasn't entirely living in splendid isolation.
Yeah, that's very funny. And here's some money for your cleaning lady.
Yes.
I like that. Okay, we're going for simplicity. That's sold. So I can see two things in TV that are very you, I think. One is the wonderful Michael Palin.
Yeah.
And the other one is a very, very good French TV series called Spiral.
Oh, yes.
Can you comment on this, please?
It's both very different. Michael Palin, I've always been a fan of his, not least because of Monty Python. But oddly enough, he was also the patron of the little charity that I ran inside Feltham.
Ah.
You know, Friends of Feltham. He was the patron. So there was always that link anyway. And then I can't remember how it happened, but I managed to be able to contact him about 2 years ago. And I invited him out for an interview on the radio station at Brixton Prison.
Brilliant.
And he came out and did this wonderful interview. And I had the privilege of coming back with him on the tube. And I thought, you're one of the nicest people I have ever met.
Yes.
From Brixton to Victoria, I thought, oh, just, you are so lovely. So unpretentious, not arrogant. So, oh, lovely.
Yeah.
So he's my national treasure.
Well, he is a sort of you know, modern English gent. And I always think he's somebody who wears very good leather lace-up tan shoes that are really, very good. And he's just somebody who's got manners, really. Yeah. That sounds old-fashioned, but manners and charm. And he's very funny.
He is. He's very natural.
We like him.
Yeah.
And we like Spiral, don't we?
Spiral, we just got in the last episode to go.
Oh, my goodness.
Addictive, as was The Bureau. There's something about the French, which I think is just amazing. It's fantastic. You get hooked by the characters. Can't really put my finger on it, but there's not a single person I know who's not watching it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's good. And you can take that with you because there are a lot of series. And
thank you.
I think Caroline Proust is a very charming charming
she's
actress.
Lovely when she smiles.
Yes.
She isn't
yes.
very often, but she's lovely.
Okay, ready? Fingers on the buzzer now, Roma. What I've decided in your knapsack is that you can have only three songs, but that they will be replenished every month, okay? First, so you've got to be ready. Simon and Garfunkel.
Right. It will be The Boxer.
Okay, I like it. I like it. I think I would take something from The Graduate, but that's good. Eva Cassidy.
It's the one which actually Sting sings to, about the golden fields. Fields of Gold.
Fields of Gold. All right, now, stand by. Fleetwood Mac.
That's the easy one. Albatross.
Oh, you're going way back.
Oh, yes.
Wow. That had a double gatefold LP sleeve with a picture of Mick Fleetwood naked, save for a hat strategically placed. There we are. You see,
oh,
I know that.
Well remembered, yeah.
That's the sort of thing. Okay, now you get your moment. Gardening at home, doing my vegetable patch with my grandchildren.
Yes.
Can you remember their names?
Yes. Isabella, who is 9, Tilly, who is 7, Stella, who is 5, Rose, who is 4, and Alfie, who is 1.
Are they sort of, you know, good gardeners? Do they, you know, take it seriously?
They do. They take all their clothes off and dive into the mud. We don't stand on ceremony. I let them do whatever they want, and I'm not allowing anyone else to get involved with the vegetable plot because I do it with them. They choose the plants. And I did it online last Easter when we were all locked down.
Gosh.
It was absolutely brilliant. I set up my iPad on the bin so they could see it.
Yeah.
And they helped me choose the plants and they watched me plant them.
Well, this is interactive.
And then I gave them a quiz about edible plants in the garden.
I thought you said you'd give them a quid.
Or they get plenty of those.
Well, that's very, very good. That's very, very good. And I think gardening is a very therapeutic thing. I don't have the Thomas gene, unfortunately, which my father, grandfather and great-grandfather had, but I still like it a lot. And we here in the shed salute people who work in the gardens. It's very, very important. That's great. Well, look, we've sort of run out of time, unfortunately. What's the Roma Hooper bit of advice?
I think if you're talking about here and now,
yeah,
which I think you are, is to not look too far ahead.
Yeah.
Avoid at all costs watching too much of the news on the television.
Very good.
Because it's pointless and engaging with some of the stuff that goes on. And actually, you just be safe, but find something to do that keeps you occupied and gives you hope. We won't be in this situation forever. Our lives may never be the same again. They're going to be different. So let's embrace the difference that we will have in the future, because there's always hope. However, whatever we have, there is hope. Never give up. I just say that to everyone, never give up. Don't give up.
Roma, honestly, you have been so great. And, it's great, actually. You're going to be coming on again. It's been really, really super. And I thank you so much for your candour and honesty about your dad and your family and all that. I mean, it's big stuff. But, you know, we live in a world where we need to say things like this. And you are a Trez groovy person. And the Cadillac, I promised you, will be on its way to you very, very soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeremy, for giving me this chance and this space to talk. It's a privilege. Actually, it really is genuinely a privilege.
Brilliant. Well, until the next time.
Adieu. Adieu, adieu.
Adieu, a biento.
Take care.
All right.
Thanks, Jeremy. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. And now it's great, great, great news because it's time for Karen Cowan. Hello, Karen.
Hi. Nice to speak to you again.
Well, one day we'll probably do more than that. See one another, you know. Well, that's the third episode. You've had two blokes and one gal. And, I think that was, for me, that was a really extraordinary. It's like watching a film, you know, all the millions of little bits that I'm going to remember from that. What did you think?
I thought it was absolutely wonderful, to be honest. I thought Roma was a wonderful person. As a psychologist, throughout the whole of her interview, I kept on thinking, surely she can't be as nice and well-balanced as this with all that's happened to her. Surely there must be some anger. And I felt I didn't hear any at all. And I felt that she's obviously found lots and lots of ways of coping. Yeah. Perhaps most of all found ways of not being angry.
Yes.
So I was incredibly impressed by her resilience and survival and downright, what sounds like downright niceness.
Yes, she is a remarkably lovely person. There's no doubt about it. This is the first time we've really talked about suicide. And it was something that I really wanted to do. And you know, gosh, Roma didn't disappoint in that respect. And I don't want our conversation just to be all about suicide. But one of the things I thought we'd just kick off with, it struck me as pretty interesting, was that she said very, very specifically that she did not think that suicide, and certainly her father's, was a selfish act. And I'm sort of very mixed up about that myself, because I could see the effect that it had on her and her brother and sister and mother and all. What do you think about that?
Well, I think a lot of research has gone into suicide, of course, obviously, especially Keith Orton in Oxford. And I think that suicide is almost always not a selfish act, because one of the things that you need in order to commit suicide is thought of as to feel as if you are a burden and that people would be better off without you. So you're not thinking, gosh, you know, I don't care about them. You're actually thinking their life will be better without me. But the thing is that once it's happened, obviously people really, really miss you and think, you know, I wish they were here, whatever kind of state they were in. As Roma said, her father sort of cleared up to some extent their troubles by dying, but she would much, much rather he had been alive.
Yeah, I mean, I get that, and I can say, you know, you can see that it can be a noble act and all that. But an awful lot of suicides are not that noble, because people just get absolutely hacked off with where they are, and you know, it's an instant decision. I'm going to jump off this building, or I mean, I don't want to denigrate it at all, but the effects are very far reaching. And really, just hearing Roma speak, you know, that she said, you know, lots of stuff happened to her mother, finding it very difficult to cope, and I think that's an understatement. But even a week ago, she was talking to her brother and sister, and they found it very difficult to talk about.
Yes, I didn't mean in any way it's a noble act, or that Roma's father's was a noble act. But I do know that many, many people feel that they're a burden, and that is why they die. But they have no idea of the devastation they leave. I remember I had a client once, and she'd found her husband dead of suicide 40 years ago, and she was still constantly asking herself the question, why? I wasn't good enough. I feel guilty. Mm. I didn't speak. So, yes, you're not aware of the devastation, I think, often when you commit suicide, that you'll leave behind. And I think it's very important for people to try to realise that people will be devastated by it. But at the time, you're thinking you're a burden.
Yeah. When you talk about noble, the thing that comes to my mind is Captain Oates from that expedition to the Antarctic, the man credited with saying, leaving his tent and the colleagues in the tent saying, I may be some time. A man who never returned, knowing that his absence would perhaps aid their survival. I may be some time. It's something that's quoted a lot as a joke, but awful when you think about it.
Mm. Whereas often suicide, and that's why it's so important for people to make contact with people like the Samaritans and so on, often suicide is actually that you don't want to live rather than you don't want to die. And not wanting to live can be sorted out dying can never be sorted out.
Yeah, very, very well put. Very, very well put. I think it's a great point. Moving on a little bit, and this is a very difficult question for you, I know, but there we go. Do you think somebody should be told their parent had committed suicide, you know, straight away, be straight with the child, as opposed to letting them know much later on in life? What's your view on that?
Well, it's rather strange because, of course, all perceived wisdom would point to the fact that the truth is always the best thing for children. Knowing the truth, clearly knowing the truth, not having garbled different stories and so on. But strangely enough, during this, and I went against all my professional leanings, I wondered, and I'd like to ask Roma this herself, I wonder if knowing when she was younger would have been helpful to her, or whether, in fact, perhaps knowing a bit later allowed her to mature a bit and accept it. But that, I must say, Jeremy, is going against all perceived wisdom. Perceived yeah. wisdom would be you must be honest with children.
Yes, yes. Because they have got an uncanny knack of knowing. And of course, what we're talking about in Roma's case, Roma Hooper's case, is something that happened, I would say, 50 years ago, when the word stiff upper lip was, I mean, it's ridiculous. It wasn't even, you know, it was much more than that. It was that people did not talk about such things.
No. And cancer was not even talked about. It was that was a sort of secret as well. All those sorts of things. Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? But I mean, you know, going on to Roma Hooper. I mean, what an extraordinary life! I loved the way she was so candid in saying, "Look, you know, when you're trying to get over something like this, you know, the first thing you want, the one thing you want, is to be loved." You want, you know, to be validated, and hence I married this chap when I was 19. And I thought, well, that's very interesting. I'd never thought of that, but
I think, Jeremy, don't you, that when you lose someone by suicide, one of the big questions, especially for children and younger people, is they can't have loved me. I must be unlovable. And in a way, that's something you know, that's obviously not the case. And then perhaps, and we'd need to speak to Roma herself about it, perhaps Roma has always been trying to find out if she is lovable, which, of course, she is. As we can jolly well tell from her interview.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I mean, you know, hearing about that, you know, winning that award, that is quite something for someone who's, I think she was 18 or 19, you know, to jump into water that was pitch dark and to rescue that child. I mean,
I wonder how that helped Roma, because what a wonderful thing. She saved somebody's life. Obviously she was so little when her father died, and I wonder how saving somebody's life affected Roma, perhaps in a positive way.
Yeah, well, of course, because she won an award, you know, the Bravery Award, the annual Bravery Award. I mean, it's fantastic. And it must, on the old self-esteem department, be going, ding, I'm sure of that.
Yes, I've been responsible for saving someone's life, yes.
Yeah, and I don't want to put her under a microscope. I think that'd be unfair. But, I mean, it does seem that when you... What seemed to be true in Roma's case was that, you know, she was looking after her mother, looking after her sister, brother, and then went on and got married. And, you know, it's like looking after. And, you know, quite extraordinary. And then that whole business of her whole career of working in prisons, but particularly young people. And she's very definite about that it's, what I like about Roma is she doesn't make any apologies. Like, well, I know they're very bad people, but she doesn't do that. And I like that a lot. But I think the really positive message from Roma, you know, whether you are one of those boys in Felton Prison or an old lag in Wandsworth or one of us, it doesn't really matter, is that, you know, you've got to try and do something yourself, take some action. And so much of this comes back to self-esteem, don't you think?
Oh, yes. And I think somehow Roma has managed to hold on to any self-esteem she had and build on it. And I wondered if it sounds like she had some good relationships with her parents' friends, which would have been very protective. And she had very good relationships with her brother and sister. And now in later life, it sounds like she has some wonderful hobbies. I loved hearing about the fishing.
Well, the fly fishing, brilliant.
I loved hearing about the fly fishing. I loved hearing about the iPad and gardening. And it sounds like she, either consciously or not, has worked on her self-esteem. She certainly said she used to feel angry, and that has gone. And that's so patently obvious listening to her.
Yes.
And obviously anger is strongly related to low self-esteem.
Well, it's a big thing, isn't it? And you know, perhaps we ought to say here, and we can put this on the website, that, you know, if you are somebody who's suffering from the after effects of a close loved one's suicide, you know, are there any helpful books? Are there any helpful organisations?
Well, the NHS website on suicide is actually very good indeed. And, of course, for children, there's the SOBS website. I just check that, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
uk-sobs.org.uk. And, of course, there's the bereavement charity cruise.org.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And
yes.
Winston's Wish.
Yes, I know, yes.
For the children of people.
No, we'll put those up as well. What's SOBS? I don't know that.
Survivors of Bereavement by Suicide.
Oh, blimey, right. Very good. Okay. I so enjoyed talking to Roma that I forgot some of the answers. But and I don't know, you know that one of the Scottish doctor, you know, three things to be happy. I think I did ask her. But she said, you know, you need something to do, someone to love, and something to hope for. And I thought she was a real, you know, technicolor advertisement for those things all the way round, you know, that she gave a lot of love, she did a lot of things, and she gave a lot of hope. I mean, it was in a different way, isn't it? I thought.
Yes, I really felt, I mean, as I say, I've only known her for the 1 hour of the interview, but I really felt she was a poster person for looking after your mental health,
yeah,
for resilience and acceptance, which are all sort of key buzzwords at the moment, and perhaps most of all for acceptance. And I realise she's still going through a lot. She's still thinking about the letter and so on with her brother and sister.
Goodness.
So she's also growing and going through things all the time. But I feel very privileged to have been able to hear you interview her, Jeremy.
Yeah, well, it's absolutely great, and I am delighted that, you know, that we have had Roma on. I never knew that she was related to Audrey Hepburn. I mean, that's obviously a very big thing. It's great, actually. Brilliant. We mustn't let her forget that. And,
yes.
You know, we will, I hope. It would be great to have Roma back on in 6 months, in a year's time, because she's got millions of stories, I know, and we should just have them. It'd be really brilliant.
It'd be wonderful. And I would like to say at the end of this that if you are feeling suicidal and as if you don't want to live, please get in touch with somebody, the Samaritans, your GP, any of the websites. Someone you trust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
See you next time.
Thank you very much indeed. Marvellous.
Thank you. Bye.
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 thank you to Stuart Bagshaw, our top engineer editor. Thank you to Bea Brooke, our top administrator, production manager. Thank you to Karen Cowan, our top psychologist. And lastly, thank you to our top guest. If you want to find out more about Shed Talks, visit our website, jeremythomastalks.co.uk. Please sign up to the newsletter. If you want to write to us, inquiries at jeremythomastalks.co.uk. You can find us on Facebook at Shed Talks, Shed Talks Twitter at JT Shed Talks, Instagram dash Jeremy Thomas Talks. So it's all been tip top and totally tidy. Stay safe, be groovy. Please sign up, support, and share this. Thanks a lot. Goodbye.